so welcome to the another Darwin seminar afternoon. For those who haven't been to one of these occasions before, the ground rules are that our speakers get an hour to speak unharried by the audience, and then we get half an hour to put our objections and praise to them. Be tea at 4:30, and then we will resume at 5 with Colin Tavich. Our first speaker is Michael Gieselin, Darwinism as Economics. Looking at his CV, he tells us that he resigned his tenure at Berkeley to become a gentleman. But it seems he wasn't entirely successful, because he then went on to hold a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1978 and a MacArthur Fellowship between 81 and 86, which is not entirely the most gentlemanly thing to do. Now a senior research fellow at the California Academy of Sciences and chair of the Center of History and Philosophy of Science. He's the author of a number of well-known books on evolution and topics, currently working on a new book, Metaphysics and the Origin of Species. So, Michael Gieselin.
Thank you. I'm going to talk today about what economics has done for biology and what biology has done for economics, and maybe what the one might do for the other in the future. And this is a rather speculative area, because it looks like a lot of things are happening right now. It's become a rather timely topic, and my own work in this area has tended to come and go. I was working on that area years ago, and now people have been saying, hey, let's get interested in this, and we're trying to get an international society of bioeconomists going, and they want me to get involved in this, and I'm saying, well, I'm kind of out of date. But nonetheless, I've had this long-standing interest in this matter, and what do I mean when I talk about economics? I define economics in the broadest sense as the science of resources. And this makes economics a very imperial discipline, and some people like that sort of thing and some people don't. Often people speak of general or universal economics as something overarching, the same way maybe you talk about a very general theory of evolution. When I talk about bioeconomics, we really haven't defined what this means, but if you're a bioeconomist, you're interested in both, and you talk to people who share that interest. We're dealing here with some interdisciplinary transfer, and that in itself is a very interesting problem. I think that what we who are interested in developing such a discipline or area of research want to do more than just transfer metaphors and jargon. It's more than just analogies that we're talking about. It's more than just maybe heuristics or problem-solving techniques. I think we can take the most fundamental principles of evolutionary biology and of economics and apply them in a larger scale, much as one might apply the what we know about halogens to both chlorine and bromine. So this we think of as a really serious effort to subsume the more particular among the more general. With that prolegomena, let me just begin with Darwin. And you have been told about my paper in Evolution in this December issue. Maybe you have read it. There will be a considerable amount of overlap with what I'm saying here. But let's go back to September 28th, approximately, 1838. Charles Darwin, who was the secretary of the Geological Society of London, read a book by Robert Malthus. Yes, he went by his middle name, who was the first professor of economics. He died a couple of years earlier. and Darwin, as a result of this, invented or discovered natural selection. Now, I'm interested in making this point about geology and economics because Darwin transformed biology into what might be called an historical science. And he also transformed biology by making it have a close connection with economics of a particular kind, of course. And in my paper in Evolution, I talk about Darwin's debt to Malthus. And when we have studied this as historians, there has been a long-standing problem of just what it was that Darwin got from Malthus. Some people say, well, nothing, it was just a stimulus, he already knew that. But if we look carefully, we find, upon reading Malthus, there was an immediate shift in the way he was thinking about what we might call ecology. He was talking about reproductive competition. That's important, and is reproductive competition within species. Very important, unless you think of natural selection as something that's this individualistic thing, competition within the species, it doesn't form the kind of plausible mechanism that we now recognize. Well, now, why was this this shift occurring in Darwin's thinking? And that's where I've had some thoughts recently. Malthus, in his work, shows what happens after there's a plague and therefore a reduction in the size of human populations. And then you get a growth of populations, and you can do this kind of graphing of the sort of thing. What happens? Well, you have the population growing, and then it levels off and reaches a kind of equilibrium. And I think that what was going on in Darwin's mind was something like this. If you think of a population in this saturated condition, you don't think of things as changing and competing reproductively in a way that would produce a change. Yes, natural selection operates at that time, but it's not obvious. If you think of the rapidly expanding population, then we know that one organism in that population is reproducing faster than the other, but it's not obvious. On the other hand, you get up here, resources are becoming even more and more tending to run out. And it's easy to conceptualize that some of those organisms are going to reproduce more than others. Some are going to be more affected by the availability of resources. And you could extend this a little way and say that if you had a diversity of organisms at this point, then some would perhaps fill what we might call empty niches. That's a later stage in this thinking. So it was clear that you have a way of thinking about population biology that will give you a possible mechanism for evolution. Well, I mentioned the next step, which is Darwin's principle of the divergence of character. Now, this is basically the point that competition is going to drive the various lineages of organisms ever more away from each other, and they're going to fill what we would call empty niches or be more efficient at utilizing resources and maybe occupy niches that had already been occupied, but maybe with more organisms. So when we think of this kind of proliferation of groups, we now talk about an adaptive radiation. That is a way of putting it in the context of a phylogenetic a diagram. This principle of the divergence of character was something that Darwin did not really understand very well until the years in which he was working on barnacles. Nobody knows why he delayed so long and spent 8 years working on the systematics of barnacles, but it was in fact his first book on evolution. Barnacles are a fine example of the kind of adaptive radiation that Darwin was able to explain. And it's also a fine example of hermaphrodites evolving into organisms with separate males and females. And that's important. I'll come back to it. As background for his work on barnacles and for other reasons, he read some works by Henri Milne-Edwards, who was a Belgian physiologist. And he invoked the principle of the physiological division of labor. That is to say, he realized that if you have separate organs doing separate functions, you get a more efficient kind of organism. So you put an anus on a animal, and you can have a more efficient way of digesting the food than if you have to go through the mouth for both getting intake and output. So specialized organs, like specialized craftsmen, allow for an increased diversity of life, an increased amount of utilization of resources, and supposedly a larger biomass. So that's how Darwin thought of this, and it was very important in his thinking. There is a really serious question among Darwin scholars as to how well Darwin understood economics. He evidently read Adam Smith when he was an undergraduate, and there's a letter about this. He doesn't mention in the letter what work of Adam Smith he read. It was probably The Wealth of Nations. On the other hand, most of his economic understanding was derived from conversations and various secondary sources. So he wasn't a very well-educated economist, but he understood a lot about the basic principles, maybe, and he got some from informal sources. And so he probably was proceeding with pretty much commonsensical thinking about division of labor and that sort of thing. Like many other persons, and that includes economists and biologists alike, Darwin simply assumed that labor becomes increasingly divided in the course of either economic development or evolutionary history. Now, interestingly enough, he had very good evidence that there is division of labor between the sexes evolving, because he had this work on barnacles. And the barnacles start out hermaphrodite, and then they get hermaphrodites plus males, and then they get just males and hermaphrodites. A remarkable thing. He had good evidence because he had the animals properly classified. He could support that. Later in his life, he may have thought that evolution can go either way, but in The Origin of Species and The Descent of Man, he says that all animals in general had been hermaphrodites at one time or another. The refutation of the notion that hermaphroditism is primitive in animals goes back to about 1895. Maybe people were doubting it earlier. And there was a Belgian malacologist named Paul Pelsenier. And he used, again, systematics, historical data. One has to have the phylogenetic tree to test that kind of hypothesis, and that's pretty important. Now, I got interested in hermaphroditism because I am a malacologist. I work on the anatomy, the functional anatomy of mollusks. And I was working on reproductive systems of a group that is hermaphroditic. And subsequent work, after I finished my work on anatomy of these reproductive systems, I realized that there was a lot of open question about what's going on with hermaphroditism. We couldn't explain sex switches in terms of the traditional explanation, which has to do with if you're male and female, you can mate with any other member of your own species in principle. So what we needed to be able to do, and what I needed to be able to do, was understand why sometimes you have labor combined and sometimes you have it divided. And I found that I can explain this pretty well using an everyday object, a pocket knife, a Swiss Army knife. You can use these for explaining all sorts of elementary economic principles, like, you know, you have, as the number of blades increases, you get what might be called diseconomies of scale and diminishing returns on various things. But let's talk about the division of labor here. You have division of labor among what we might call the blades. And here's the really important one, the corkscrew. That's the one I always carry it for. At any rate, you don't have this united combined with anything else. And the basic principle here is that when functions interfere with each other, you divide labor. When they do not interfere with each other or complement each other, you combine it. So here we have a can opener, and up here is a little screwdriver. So that labor is here divided, or pardon me, it's combined, and here we have another thing, can opener, screwdriver, and a wire stripper. So that gets one to understand that there are particular circumstances or classes of circumstances under which division and combination are valuable or workable or selectively advantageous, if you wish. There were some points that needed to be elaborated on. For instance, you can have temporal or spatial division of labor. You can do one thing after another, and that had to do with my explanation for why fish switch sex and so forth. Another thing, however, that was widely overlooked and often is the distinction between the kind of competitive division of labor that you get in a free enterprise economy and the cooperative division of labor that you might get within an organism in which everything is optimized as a whole. Interestingly enough, this was not very well understood by 19th century social scientists. Now, when I started telling economists about this, they thought it was kind of interesting, and it turns out that division of labor has been something that has been largely overlooked by economists. They seem not to have done much work on it since Adam Smith, and that has seemed something of a curiosity. Before I leave the topic of the division of labor, I want to say a little bit about how one might apply the division of labor or think about it in a way that would help us do better philosophy of biology. What's a function, for example? This is a rather contentious topic in the philosophy of biology, and people are arguing about whether we should give it an evolutionary definition. I think not. But certainly a good evolutionist would not want to call it the purpose of an organ of a part. We wouldn't want to call it a final cause, which means that for the sake of which something exists. We don't think teleologically if we are good Darwinists. Now, this isn't a simple topic, but I do want to suggest that anatomists and everybody else has long been aware of the fact that certain functions are concentrated, certain of the things that animals or plants do are concentrated in particular organs. There is specialization. It's a brute fact. And so people haven't been realizing in giving these functional ascriptions, what they're doing is talking about the results of the division of labor. How is labor divided in the body of the organism? This is not the sort of explanation that's going to satisfy everybody, but at least it suggests how an economic perspective on some of these philosophical questions might be useful. I'm going to go back to Darwin now and his views on progress, which I discussed in my evolution paper. I wrote it in response to various people, including Stephen Jay Gould, who I argued with about this point. It's a very controversial topic, progress. And I looked quite hard at Darwin's writings about this. He seems to have roughly equated evolutionary and historical and technological progress. Well, Darwin, as I mentioned in my paper, was a user and, in fact, an improver of microscopes, and he knew about eyes, which are some similarities, any optical instrument. You might want to think of progress in the evolution of the eye as things like putting a lens on something that didn't already have one, and putting an iris, and so forth. Technological in a, of course, somewhat metaphorical sense. Now, such innovations would tend to accumulate during the passage of time, and it doesn't matter whether we're dealing with technological evolution in the ordinary sense or with biological evolution. The basic idea would be that gradually these things would accumulate, and they might be lost, but they would tend to accumulate that way. Darwin definitely said that progress occurs and that it's real. He thought that modern animals, say, transported back into the Mesozoic, would outcompete the Mesozoic organisms. They would beat them all hollow in competition. He called this competitive highness. Well, you might think of an analogy. Suppose you take a 1990s baseball team and transport it back into the 1920s, if this could be done. And perhaps it couldn't be done, of course. But you would find probably the modern players outperforming the earlier ones. And the reason is that they gradually learned techniques for hitting the ball in the right place and holding the bat just right and so forth. This is not a country where a lot of baseball is played, but you read Stephen Jay Gould, and he was giving the example of, they keep changing the rules because the baseball players are developing more and more skills. And my point was that that's what Darwin meant by progress, that's what I mean by progress, that's what a lot of us mean by progress, even though the rules change and you can have Red Queen type phenomena and all that sort of thing. So Darwin discussed this in the third edition of The Origin of Species, if you want to see how he elaborated upon that sort of thing. Well, he was writing at a time when there were other ideas about progress, and he was very critical of people like Lamarck and Herbert Spencer, who had quite different views. And I think we can say that these theories he was dealing with had a very different metaphysical basis for them. The other writers were presupposing a kind of a stronger necessity and assuming much less contingency. They tended to be teleological. There was a notion of somehow the organisms were striving to become more and more like man. And there would be a change from one condition to another, not from one condition to maybe a variety of possible derived conditions, any one of which might be considered progress. There was often a false analogy invoked between embryological development and evolutionary change, phylogeny as we call it. A lot of these thinkers were presupposing what we call orthogenesis, that evolution is very much like embryological development. And you get that in the writings of Herbert Spencer, for example, if you can stomach them. Now, Darwin did realize there were quite problems with this. He recognized that progress in different situations and different lineages is not going to be commensurable. Well, we can think of cameras undergoing technological development or computers. How do you compare what happens to a computer with a camera? You can think about that a little. It's hard to make them commensurable. Well, how about starting with brachiopods and other kinds of animals, orchids and so forth? There's a directional change, but there's no natural scale. That's the same kind of problem that we biologists have to deal with when we're trying to find an index for things like diversity and amount of and how to equate families and orders in different phyla and so forth. A very difficult problem, and he recognized it very well. Okay, so much for Darwin for a while. What might biology further import from economics? I'd say there are all sorts of things, but in many cases it looks kind of arcane and odd. I have a friend, Janet Landa, who's an economist from Toronto, and she's was a student of James Buchanan, and he had a theory called the theory of clubs. The economists here may know about it. She applied it to schools of fish, and the intellectual apparatus is all there. She just moved it from one area to another, and it's very interesting. I'm just trying to get her to publish that. I think that if we learn to think as biologists more about competition the way economists do and get away from the notion of it's being tending to be pretty much conflict, as some people do at any rate, we'd be somewhat better off. I'm not an economist, so I'm not going to say exactly what we might import. How about the other way around? Taking ideas from biology into economics. There is a lot about analogies between natural selection and what goes on in economic processes. Are firms selected and that sort of thing? I'm not going to say much about that. It's not my area, but we should recognize that that kind of enterprise exists, and a lot of people are working on it. I think, however, that there are a variety of possibilities, and some of these may not be the kind of thing that economists really want. I just attended a meeting in Germany, and Professor Ulrich Witt of Jena was there. He has the idea that we might have a more realistic approach to preferences. Does one go after sex or food or what? Traditionally, in economics theory, one isn't supposed to say very much about what the preferences are. They're supposed to be taken as something that's given, and are dealt with at a pretty high level of abstraction. Now, it's true that biology can provide data, and one can study preferences in the laboratory. The trouble is, then economics has to become a bit more like natural history, and it sheds, to some extent, the notion that it's very much like theoretical physics and has to become quite empirical. Well, what are we to do with economic man? Might we replace economic man with something else? And there's a, it seems to me, a good idea, but there are all sorts of pitfalls and unintended consequences. Charles Elworthy recently published a book, and I've got a review of it in Economic Journal. Don't know if it's been published yet. And his book is entitled Homo Biologicus. And the problems I addressed in my review are these. First, Homo Economicus is not equivalent to an organism or to a species in economic theory. In biological theory, a Homo sapiens is not equivalent to, has nothing really equivalent to it in economics. What Homo Economicus is an abstract, a rational decision maker. And it doesn't have to be a human being. It could be a Martian or something that lived way the far reaches of the universe or any time at all, whenever. So there would be laws of nature for this rational decision making, and we're calling it Homo Economicus just because we have to call it something. Elworthy's Homo Biologicus, and this is my second criticism, would perhaps more aptly be called Homo Sociobiologicus Dawkinsi. It's an importation of the particulars of sociobiology, human sociobiology, as understood by present-day sociobiologists. I should point out that there seems to be a difference in taste with respect to some kinds of sociobiology. I think in the USA we are a little bit less apt to take Dawkins's writings seriously. We read them, we enjoy them, but I don't. I think he's less of a figure in our country. There is a general problem with popularizers. If an economist asks me what I think of Stephen Jay Gould, for instance, I don't tell them. I just ask them what they think of his colleague John Kenneth Galbraith, and they seem to have something of the same hesitancy about that particular popularizer. Well, I think that a lot of rather dubious metaphysics has crept into a sociobiological discourse. I'm not going to blame anybody or anything like that, but it does seem to me that if we shifted our emphasis to talking more about, or particularly thinking more about, the economic aspect of Darwinism, we might find our thinking more balanced and more clear. And I would emphasize very strongly that if you read the literature on social behavior, or particularly on foraging theory and that kind of thing, this is the economic aspect of Darwinism. I don't see any real contradiction. But I do think that if we start calling the genome the final cause of the rest of the body, we're perhaps getting into some unfortunate excesses. We shouldn't be talking about final causes in this circumstance. And I would be very happy to think about genes a lot. And one way we might better think about them is to consider them resources. And if one thinks of them as resources, then one perhaps doesn't think of them as sort of in the driver's seat of the vehicle, so to speak. I'm critical of the selfish gene notion. That's pretty obvious. And Dawkins has addressed some of these notions. He talks about selfish genes. And he admits that many of the so-called genes he's talking about are alleles, which are chromosomal deletions. If you look at a spread your DNA, you'd have diploids, and perhaps part of the DNA would be just eliminated, then you'd have to shorten this stretch and so forth, but this would be a deletion, something left out. The allele, which is not left out, is the equivalent of the same locus. Well, you get rid of some of this, and you get what I call a selfish chromosomal deletion. Well, Dawkins admits that there's an economic advantage to getting rid of some of this DNA, but he kind of glosses it over, and I really feel like that kind of economic advantage shows the limitations, at any rate, of that particular approach. So I would think of the whole organism as being something that allocates and might be talked about as an allocator rather than a vehicle or something like that. And the organisms do seem to gain certain advantages from getting rid of DNA, and a lot of organisms do that. It just is one of the ways in which one might focus economic arguments that might clarify some of these points. And I also think that focusing on the gene level tends to divert attention from the other things that are going on, to the point of getting some metaphysical excesses in there and some gross distortions, of course. Let me say a little bit more about that particular line of reasoning. Next month, you're going to have a lecture by David Hull in this room, I guess, June 13th. David Hull and I, for the last 25 and 30 years, have been arguing for a new ontology, a new conception of what species are and what the fundamental units in the living world are. And Hull has written a paper in which he talks about genes as replicators following Dawkins, and he talks about organisms as interactors. Well, all this relates to the idea that we're dealing with a structured hierarchical world in which we have whole-part relationships. And so organisms are parts of species. They are not members of a class, which would make a species an abstraction. So we call species individuals, and we say there are wholes and parts, and we get individuals at different levels. So, for instance, we have genes. Yes, we do have genes, and genes are these individuals, we say, and they do a particular thing. They replicate. They do a lot of other things, too. But, or they are replicated, you might prefer to say. Well, organisms are real, too. They are individuals, and they are concrete things. And they do things like copulate. Species, we also think of them as these concrete, particular things which do things. They engage in processes. They speciate. What else they do, that's an interesting question, but they at least do that. Genera, on the other hand, they're just historical things. Yes, they are concrete, single things, but they don't do much of anything because they're just descendants of a common ancestor. They don't have any real capacity to adapt or anything like that, or be adapted, evolve. Now, the reason why such things can do anything is that they are not abstractions. They are concrete. And if one looks in the wrong place, one might find, one might not properly locate the activity of interest, the processes. It's easy to see that species don't copulate, organisms organisms don't speciate, that kind of thing. Now, all that kind of analysis has been very important, even when it's not carried out explicitly. Back in the 1960s and the early 70s, a lot of us, I was involved very much in this, pretty much got rid of the notion that we have species-level adaptations. And that makes sense because it's very hard to imagine how you could get a species getting adapted by competition between organisms. And that's one reason I got involved in hermaphroditism. Very interesting bunch of questions. People have been trying to say why it's good for the species, switch and ask why it's, how it's selected at the organismal level. You get different answers, and very likely they're right. But at the same time, we were affirming that, or at least some of us were affirming that you have supraorganismal things going on. You have supraorganismal units. And these are important in their own right. I had a tremendous difficulty getting this notion across, including to David Hull, who is its major advocate these days, along with me, I guess. I managed to get the idea across by comparing biological species to the firms and corporations of economics. It's a lot easier to think of maybe a business as something more than just an abstraction out of the individual organisms. You can think of it as a composite whole, something that does something over and above what the organism itself does. So you can think about competition between firms, you can think about firms having resources over and above what a single employee might have. Well, when we emphasize the role of the individual organism in selection, it would be very easy to deny that the higher level entities do anything at all. But Darwin explained social behavior in insects as due to the family being selected as a single thing, and he referred it to it, the family, as an individual. And so you could have familial selection or something of the sort. Well, we got rid of a lot of that notion of competition between groups, but we couldn't rule it out altogether, and the question is should we rule out everything completely? There have been discussions of the possibility of species selection. You may have heard of this sort of thing. That seems somewhat implausible, but people have advocated it. And if species are these concrete wholes, these individuals, then at least it's plausible. Well, recently, George Williams, in his latest book, has denied that species have this character of individuality. He gives no arguments. He merely says that this notion is a fallacy. Daniel Dennett, in his latest book, likewise denies it. He doesn't tell us why. He says he agrees with George Williams, and he's read the anthology in which the arguments are laid out, and he rejects them. I think that there's an ulterior motive to rejecting that individuality notion, which is that it would be very convenient if we didn't have to face up to the possibility that at least something is going on at those higher levels. You get rid of the species as being more than an abstraction, then it's very easy to get rid of the organism as more than an abstraction. And I think that the motivation there is perhaps somewhat transparent. no more comment on that. I do want to say a little more about how this notion that species are concrete, particular things fits in with the notions of history and law and their importance in sciences such as economics and biology. If you think of the world as consisting of all sorts of these individual, particular things, such as you and me and England and Homo sapiens, these entities have biographies, they have histories, but you wouldn't say that there are any laws for any one of such things. When we generalize and formulate laws, we're talking about kinds of things. There are laws for kinds of species, laws for kinds of political organizations, perhaps, but none for Homo sapiens or for General Motors or for Henry VIII. So we're getting different kinds of generalizations. We make that distinction, and we see that in evolutionary biology, we do have history, and it's very important. I was mentioning classification and the importance of Darwin's barnacle taxonomy in his life. I would say that in a crude sense, systematics and gives the history, and something else gives the laws. Economic laws are some of those laws. In our research on evolutionary biology, both history and laws are important. We use the laws to explain the history, and then we find out something about the history that gets us thinking maybe we should revise the laws. Well, this suggests that maybe one thing that bioeconomists might do is to produce explanatory narrative history. We have some of that. We have in economics some technological history which explains what goes on in terms of innovations. Putting a collar on a horse so that it doesn't, in a, of a kind that doesn't choke off the air supply is an example you may have, you probably heard of. We have a nice one that's sort of similar to that in functional anatomy of vertebrates. Turns out that a lot of what has happened in the evolution of the locomotory and skeletal system in tetrapod vertebrates, at any rate, is an ability to breathe and run at the same time. A lizard can run very fast, but while it's running, it has to hold its breath. It can't breathe. And that gives you a very different set of opportunities, different ways to forage, different ways to find food, and that sort of thing. Now, I could certainly write a book on the evolution of the invertebrates in which I did it from that standpoint, and it might be fun. But that's neither here nor there. What if we were to suggest that economists might be doing that sort of thing a lot more, and economics might become more like natural history? I suspect that economists would insist that a lot of their prestige depends on not doing that kind of thing. They want to be a sort of ahistorical, like ahistorical physics, and have that sort of image. People are having a hard time because of this. Alexander Rosenberg, probably if you're an economist, know of what he's been trying to do. He's been saying that economics is really nothing more than a mathematical exercise. I once gave a seminar at a place where Rosenberg was teaching, and we got along fine, but I said that biology, it seems to me, is an historical science, and he got kind of angry and said it shouldn't be. But the really interesting thing in the world is laws, and this history is just unimportant. I have a different view of the relative importance of history and law. I like to see them together and as a scientist who's working toward the elucidation of both, I think the two ought to be coordinated, and you ought to have a science which has both aspects to it. Rosenberg has argued that economics hasn't improved much in its predictive power since about 1870. I don't know if that's true, but I can say that the kind of economic biology that has interested me has made a lot of progress in the last few years. Chernoff's work on sex allocation theory is a fine example. And maybe our success is owing to several things. One is we study animals and plants that aren't clever enough to outsmart us, get a much simpler system, easier to study. We aren't restricting ourselves to one species. Foraging theory applies to all sorts of things. And so we might have laws there. And of course, we have a long-standing empirical tradition in biology. I think there's some marketing going on here and so forth. When economists and biologists take a stance as to what's the basic thing their science ought to be about, it looks to me as if economists try to make themselves look more like physicists than they really are, and sociobiologists may tend to overemphasize the role of genetics, and this may be largely a marketing ploy. Ostentatious display and deceptive advertising perhaps are too strong to say that, to invoke, but there may be something of that. If we want to understand such goings-on, it helps to look at the history of the discipline. I have no pretensions to being an expert on the history of economics. I know a little about it. But I think it might reasonably be said that it was an historical accident that economics got defined and got its image as a social science. Economists tended to be interested in problems like the nature and causes of the wealth of nations and that kind of thing. Alfred Marshall, however, was strongly impressed by its relation to biology. He thought of biology as a mecca of economists. And a lot of people have tried to restore things, or about to change things in that direction. But there has been this long tendency in the social sciences of trying to make, to overcome the image of a soft science and something that is not as respectable as, say, an experimental or a highly rigorous science of one kind or another. And so this tends to give, this is, one doesn't want to destroy that image, and I suspect that one gets entrained in this so that you get a tradition of thinking that, yes, economics is supposed to be like physics, and that would probably be handed from generation to generation of students and has become something of an exception. Well, how about biology? Do we biologists do the same sort of thing? And I answer yes, of course we do. If you read the textbooks and perhaps a stripped down history of evolutionary biology, the picture we get is sort of like this. Darwin was never really able to establish the truth of his theory of natural selection. It became unfashionable. And finally, around the 30s and 40s, genetics came to the rescue, filled in the holes, and the result was the synthetic theory based on genetics. You look at genetics in the synthetics theory, yes, it's, of course it's there, and it's very important, but I don't think that's really quite what happened. Darwin, if we go back and read him, and this was done in 1959, around 1959, with a centennial celebration of the origin, he got quite a satisfactory theory with remarkably little knowledge of what goes on in transmission of characters, of things from one generation to another. And the problems that were arising were partly due to false assumptions about genetics. Well, you did get rid of those, and that really helped. But the geneticists had some of these notions like mutationism saltationism and that kind of thing that supposedly were plausible. These lost plausibility, and always that was left was Darwinism, and the geneticists continued to work, and they began making lots of important contributions, and so we did get a new kind of Darwinism. But the trouble is that genetics did not quite do all the things that it is supposed to do according to this notion. Really, we still continue to be asking the question of what are the selection pressures, how are the organisms set up, and how are they competing reproductively. But it's the kind of notion that's useful for impressing undergraduates and impressing the layman. You might compare it to the myth one reads in textbooks that fossils are the best evidence for evolution. Any geologist can tell you that's not true, but that's how it's sold. It's plausible. And most textbooks I've looked at don't mention what the real evidence that was compelling for Darwin was and what should be compelling for us, namely biogeography. And insofar as the fossil record enters in, it's the relationship of local faunas to the present, to the earlier ones in the same area. So this kind of thing got entrained in the textbooks. I think that looking at what the opportunities are and what the different possibilities of thinking about evolution in economic terms might be a better way to conduct our research. And I think I've talked long enough. Thank you. Time's up.
Okay, so we have time for questions. Why don't you select questions? You put your hand up if you'd like to make a question. Perhaps you could say your name and affiliation.
Definitely not. I mean, I would say that Homo sapiens is one of innumerable species, and that economic thinking, in a broad sense, should be applicable to all of them. Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure what you mean. Of course, we as a species have this remarkable common possession, which is the capacity to communicate and do other things by means of language. And this makes it a very unusual species. And in fact, we have this thing called language, which we do phylogenetics with language. And we can do all sorts of economic studies on language and efficiency of communication and that kind of thing. So this is one thing that makes our own species very complicated and in many important respects quite different from most other species. On the other hand, we do have phenomena among other species which are somewhat comparable to language. There are various kinds of communication, pheromones, of signaling, of all sorts of things. And then studying that kind of thing, one can have a science that deals economically with communication within species. And then, of course, there's also communication between species, as in pollinators and flowers and that kind of thing. So, yes, we are different, but there is at least some similarity to other species. Yes?
On the concept of the pheromone, could you discuss the military unit? I mean, might trace the history of the development of species. In our development of our capacity to undertake military weaponry, not military weaponry, would you see the military as the pheromone influence in the concept that you use for
pheromone? Right.
When one considers these supraorganismal wholes, one finds that they are held together in different ways. And a military unit is one in which the parts are strongly subordinated to a something that runs, that controls the whole. You get the same kind of subordination between the productive units of a university or of a factory or perhaps a larger productive unit, and that is a perfectly legitimate example. But you have all sorts of variants, so that some organizations are very loosely organized and so forth. Comparing that is where the analogy between a species and a firm breaks down, because you don't have anybody directing the whole species. And you don't have species-level adaptation, but you do have some competition within a firm, so that, and it's not very much, it's not suppressed. Well, I mean, you have a lot of competition within the firm as well as between them, and that's one way of asking what's going on in these various units. I don't like to push that analogy too far. I introduced it partly just to get the idea across that you have units above the level of the organism, and they are important, and they participate in various kinds of processes, including competition, which is really important in understanding economics or evolutionary biology. Yes.
Could you
Well, I would certainly say that Darwin went to medical school in Edinburgh, and that Scottish Enlightened tradition was part of his family heritage, really. And yes, he did get something out of reading his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin. And he was very interested in, he shared some interest with them, and of course, and there was an idea of, you try to explain things in terms of natural processes and so forth. That is a significant aspect to it philosophically. However, with the kind of Enlightenment attitude that Erasmus Darwin had, there was deism. Darwin was something of a deist. There was the idea that God wound up the clock and just let things run, and therefore one should try to explain things in terms of laws of nature and that had been ordained by God, and you could have a pretty providential notion of what's of the natural economy. And you can see this by reading Erasmus Darwin and comparing the particular issues that he addressed and seeing how Darwin, the elder and the younger Darwin, dealt with the same problem. Erasmus Darwin has some fine lines like, "And one great slaughterhouse, the living world." He thought that the world was quite combative, and so there are wars of organic being. But that wasn't playing quite the same role that it played in Charles Darwin's thinking. A good example is the peacock's tail. Erasmus Darwin thought that and for sexual selection in general, people have attributed sexual selection to Erasmus Darwin. What Erasmus Darwin was saying is, gee, you get these stags fighting, they are seeing to it that the most Aryan genes propagate the race. You get this notion of eugenical selection, which is a stabilizing selection. It's not producing change, it's keeping things the same. And you get Darwin saying, well, now he's reading somewhere, he says, suppose peahen admires peacock's tail as much as we do. That was an early stage before he discovered sexual selection. But for Darwin, the notion, he acknowledged the possibility that sexual selection had this eugenic effect, as a lot of modern evolutionary biologists do, but Darwin was seeing this more as a source of maladaptation and that kind of thing. So he was not looking upon this competitive natural economy as being providential. He was looking on it as a sort of historical and contingent thing, and was struggling down the years to get a less teleological view of things. I don't know if I've answered that. Sir.
I'm in Tang Yi. You started your lecture Now it has a more deep relationship than I would.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid I'm not quite sure that I got that point. I mean, during the discussion of the topics of the relationship between the economists and others, it seems to me that you just point out some kind of analysis that's going on. So could you explain more about what kind of characteristic can be set to a deep relationship?
Sure. I think that's a very good question, and I must say I tried to present my my position in as few words as possible, and I might very well save it till the discussion period. I think that there are laws of nature that apply to more than one, apply to a broad area of a variety of kinds of things. And what I'm looking for is laws of nature about things like diminishing returns in, and well, take the, for example, the extent of the the division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. Well, you can generalize that. You might have to abstract it a little bit, but I think this would apply very well to not just human economic systems, but it applies very nicely to insect colonies. And one way to think about this is that upper limits to the size of an insect colony, for instance. Termite nests or ant hills and that sort of thing. The organisms, the larger insect colonies occur in things like termites, which have a concentrated food supply, lots of local areas, so they don't have to go very far to get a lot of food. So you can have a fairly big thing, and you can have more specialists. In some social insect colonies, you have colonies that move from one place to another and are not central place foragers, as the terminology goes. They can have a larger, they can extend what we would call the market by moving a bit, and that allows for more specialization and that sort of thing. So I would apply these things in a rather abstract way to a variety of items. I think that kind of principle is highly applicable across species into different kinds of economies. I've thought of applying optimal foraging theory to explaining how one does a literature search and that kind of thing. That's an amusing analogy. So does that answer the question? Yes.
Biologists, why economists are so keen on growth?
Yeah, I'll tell you. there was a British humorist, and he did a little stunt, and it was two taxi drivers. One had been to from in London. One had been to America. The other had not. And one of them said, "Well, there's no class system in America," and the other said, "Well, that's funny. What motivates people? Greed." And I think that that economists are interested in our own situation and in our the kind of economy that we have. And they see change taking place, and the idea is that growth
people are interested in growth. They're meeting a demand for justification of growth and for that kind of thing. Now some people like growth. I was talking to a guy named Gordon Getty, who happens to be a billionaire, and he is down on growth. I think he has enough money as it is. And a lot of people have a vested interest in growth. I used to live in a nice little seaside community, and there were certain people who wanted growth there. I didn't want it. I would have been happy to live in a slightly larger community, but you get too many tourists and all those things. I really think that economists are partly in the business of business. Maybe that's not a satisfactory answer. I'm not an economist. I don't know. No, it's not. Yeah.
Brian McGee, can I offer a genuinely brief anecdote? You say that it's a question among scholars how much economics Darwin knew or understood. A few years ago, I was browsing through Darwin's library down the house. I came across, very excited to come across, the copy of Das Kapital that Marx personally gave to Darwin, inscribed to Dr. Darwin's highest esteem, etc. And they also display the letter of thanks that Darwin sent to Marx. Of course, I can't remember the exact words, but the thrust is very much, dear Dr. Marx, very grateful for your book. This is not my field, of course, but I recognize the high quality of your work, and I have the highest regard, etc., etc. When you look at the actual volume of Das Kapital, only about the first 60 pages are cut.
Well, some of us feel about the same way about certain contemporary authors. I don't know if you've tried to read Stu Kaufman's book. A lot of people say the first. I don't know how many chapters I got through. Darwin, of course, there was one time he wrote in a letter, "Political economy makes me ill." Now, he may have been exaggerating. There's a problem, of course, when you read Darwin, that he was trying to be nice to all sorts of people. And he was very careful when somebody sent him a book to say thank you and keep me on your reprint list and that sort of thing. And it's hard to tell, but the nice thing is that the pages are not all cut. Yeah, that's true. But you see, he did cut theories.
Yeah.
Or somebody did. You can't be sure. Maybe it was his daughter or something. Pete Goldie is here.
You mentioned the difficulty of measuring diversity on arbitrary groups. And the only measures I know are on species level and the mechanism derives from information theory. Do you think that the measurement of the larger groups would benefit from using formulas and economic theories?
If one had some kind of economic unit for the larger groups, then it might make a certain amount of sense. The trouble is that there doesn't seem to be any. The reason why we use species diversity, and it's a very thing of very limited utility, it turns out, is that we at least have a species definition so that we can say these things have at least one thing in common, being species. The trouble is that this doesn't correlate very well with a lot of other things. I mean, you can have a closely related species that are quite heterogeneous, have some heterogeneity economically, and so forth. A lot of this diversity study is really not telling us the kind of thing we would really like to have. And maybe what we should be looking for is comparing niches, comparing occupied niches, that kind of thing, if you can do it. That's a tricky question. I do address this issue in my forthcoming book, but you have to go through a lot of preliminary handstands and so forth to follow what I'm up to. Yes.
Professor, I think a slight error may have crept into your lecture because you mentioned that Darwin didn't agree with Herbert Spencer, but actually I think that in The Ascent of Man, he speaks sympathetically of Spencer and actually states that if unfit elements are allowed to propagate within a species, you damage that species.
Yes, I was too elliptical on that and didn't give you a total analysis of Darwin's relationship to Spencer, which was quite mixed and is rather hard to evaluate. If you want to know what Darwin's relationship to Spencer is, you have to be careful not to read the expurgated edition of his so-called autobiography, because he says some really nasty things about Spencer there. But then he thought that Spencer had said some very intelligent things about his philosophy, his philosophical approach, Darwin's philosophical approach to testing the hypothesis. And they were on good terms. They needed to be. They were both supposedly evolutionists, and Darwin needed all the support as that he could get. And they tried to be nice to each other, and they succeeded. But they did have some important differences in their attitudes toward progress and competition and some of those things. I do agree that Darwin had some of the attitudes one finds in among people like Spencer, who were real so-called social Darwinists. He did not deny that competition should be allowed to go on as it does and so forth. He had a lot of those ideas, quite true. But he did not have the orthogenesis. That was what I was trying to emphasize. Yes?
Jeffrey Miller, LSE. It seems like some of the most important theoretical advances in evolutionary biology in the last few decades come from moving away from a sort of narrow Malthusian notion of economics. Maybe in the 50s, it seems like biology used economic metaphors to the extent that there was competition without marketing. But the rise of sexual selection theory, the rise of Dawkins-Krebs communication theory, the rise of runaway arms race theory, all sort of move away from that narrow economic model of a species trying to extract maximum resources from the environment. So I just want to point out there's a pitfall in biologists picking up economic metaphors without necessarily understanding, say, the full breadth of contemporary economics, which includes, you know, Gary Becker's work on families and capital and game theory and so forth. So we don't want to move backwards to just focus on material resources.
I think that's a very good point, and I think that there are all sorts of pitfalls there, and in interdisciplinary work, there is a tendency that the only thing that will get transferred is jargon, and that the jargon will not be properly understood. Words in science are often really unintelligible apart from the theoretical context in which they are used. And so if you try to take a notion from one area to another, very often it will be differently interpreted by the person who is taking it up, for the simple reason that it's very hard to get the whole conceptual basis out of that. And I read an article on sociology and economics lately, putting my hands just yesterday, I guess, And this was a point that was being made. It's very often, it's very simple and inaccurate transfer of ideas from one area to another. And gene, I mean, I have some idea of what a gene is, and a lot of other people do, but you really have to know things like transmission genetics. Genes are not the same thing as developmental genetics genes. You've got to pick a long list of what the possibilities are, and it's very easy to treat this simplistically and to miss things. Either you get it wrong or you overlook something, so that's a very important point.
Please. I'm just not quite clear why you think you need your new ontology.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because you believe that the higher level organisms are actually necessary for causal explanation, or is it simply that the explanations are easier to kind of shortcut if you agree that these things exist? Do you really need them? Can you not explain any phenomena that you want by complicated interactions at a lower level?
Mm-hmm. That's a challenging question. I believe that if such things exist, they may in fact do something. And this may in fact not be treatable by a reductionist approach such as suggested. I mean, that's what I say when I have my back to the wall. I have looked at a lot of, for instance, Niles Eldridge. First met him when he took a summer course with me years ago at the Marine Laboratory. And have been following his career ever since. I was there when the Eldridge Gould thing was presented at the meeting of the geological, society was it? Anyway, I was there. I've been following with enthusiasm, and for obvious reasons, because he took this notion of higher level units and he ran with it, and the results were very disappointing. At the species level, very little evidence for species level interactions, but we can say that species do things, and that they do things over and above what the organisms do, or they have, and you might want to argue about this, but if you look at a species as providing its component organisms with a store of potential genetic variability and that kind of thing, it becomes sort of like a trading network or whatever. The Russian authors for a while were writing about calling what we call a gene pool a gene fund. That might be a better metaphor. So I do think that these higher level phenomena are real and can be understood, and if you ignore them, you leave something out. How one becomes a kind of pseudo-nominalist and thinks in terms of oneself as only what the component atoms do, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll have to call a halt here. But there's a nice little custom in these Darwin seminars of presenting the speaker with some books.
Oh.
Here I have African Exodus by Chris Stringer and Robin McKee. This is a present to you from the publishers, Jonathan Cape.
Oh.
And I also have here Colin Tudge's wonderful book, The Day Before Yesterday, a signed copy.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much.
On the upper floor of the students' cafe, I see tea on this door over here. So through this door, if we could meet back here promptly at 5:00.
Nobel Prize winner. He deserves that. think the world is a toast for it.
Okay, so perhaps we should start. Let me draw attention first to the next Darwin seminar, which is on Thursday the 13th of June with David Hull and Robert Frank. The details are up here on the screen. Let me also say that after this session at 6:30, there will be drinks, which all are welcome, in the students' cafe, or alternatively for the academically minded. I gather there's a lecture by Elaine Morgan on the aquatic ape in the library at Conway Hall. There'll be three lectures for the really serious book. Now our speaker is for the second session is Colin Tudge. His title is The Day Before Yesterday, Farming, Conservation and the End of Eden. Colin Tudge read zoology at Cambridge and went on to become a science writer with New Scientist and the BBC. He's a prolific author whose recent book, Day Before Yesterday, was awarded the British Petroleum Conservation Book Prize. He's a research associate currently at the centre here at LSE, where he says he is having a whale of a time. Colin Tudge.
I was, actually.
Can I just turn that thing off? I want to put my slide on. Just dim the lights again. This is the slide. It's Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, painted by Gainsborough. I put it up partly because I think it's a nice picture, brighten the place up a bit, partly so I can slip away under cover of darkness, but also because I want to make a serious point, not now but later, which is that these people and people like this did something which I think is going to be very, very necessary in the 21st century, which is that they took, as it were, they took hold of landscape by the scruff of the neck and they turned it the way they wanted to turn it. They had this. They looked like good conservatives. They were, in fact, tremendously radical in their approach to landscape, and that's what we need to be. The difference, of course, is, and it is a very, very big difference, is that we need to do precisely opposite to what they did. Their aspirations, what they were trying to achieve in landscape, is absolutely antithetical to what we should be trying to achieve in the 21st century. I hope this will restore the light. You never know, it will. And I'll just get rid of the English gentry for 1 minute and get on with the talk. Most of the lectures in the Darwin series are deeply theoretical, and they talk about the laws, as Michael said, of that lie behind evolution. My talk isn't like that. Mine is an exercise in natural history. Excuse me. And what I want to talk about is actually the state of the world, how human beings got to be in the condition they're in now, what impact we're having on other species, how we got to be in this particular condition, and what is likely to be happening in the future, whether in fact the human species can survive the next few hundred or thousand or indeed a million years, whether other species can, what we need to do in order to help them to get through that long period. I take it to be the reason, that I have various words in my title, such as farming and conservation, is that it seems to me that farming is the absolutely crucial thing that we have done in the past that makes us as powerful and as influential as we are. That might seem pretty obvious, but it needs stating. The point being that we have got to be the way we are. We have got to be as dominant as we are, basically because we are a super intelligent species, and I'll come back to that. But there's no point in simply being super intelligent unless you somehow interact with your environment. There's no good being intelligent and being a couch potato. And the point about human beings is that they interact with the environment through farming. And this single activity has transformed the ecology of the entire world and transformed us, transformed our status in the world. And that's why it's the thing that has to be discussed and why the thing that is crucial for the future. And the reason conservation has crept in is because I just take it to be self-evident that in the future it would be much better for human beings to be living in the company of other animals, and indeed of other plants, but let's stick to animals, than not to be doing so. And people give all sorts of reasons why this might be the case, and most of the reasons that they give are essentially anthropocentric. Like they say other animals are going to be economically important, or other animals are going to be a resource of genes, and so on and so on. I think the best of the anthropocentric arguments, or at least the one that convinces me most, is actually the aesthetic one, which says that the elimination, for example, of the tiger would be aesthetically equivalent to, let us say, burning down the National Gallery and the Louvre and the Prado and a few others besides. And once you start to think of animals as being important in this kind of way, you start to get some kind of insight into why conservation is important. But actually, I don't think the anthropocentric arguments by themselves are really enough. I think in the end, you have to say the reason that we should be trying to look after other animals is because it's right to do so. It's a simple moral dogmatic statement. And in the end, most moral statements finish up as being dogmatic statements, which you then support post hoc with all kinds of argument. But in the end, moral statements are a simple assertion. And the assertion is that it's right to look after other creatures. I suppose the underlying principle is noblesse oblige. If you go down the economic route and say it's economically desirable to keep other animals alive, then I think those kind of arguments are just extremely vulnerable. Because if, for example, it's profitable for Aborigines in Kakadu to keep marsupials going and lizards going and so on in order to attract tourists, in order that they can make an income, then one has to say, well, surely it will be more desirable if they discover uranium to get rid of the macropods and to get rid of the lizards and to mine the uranium. And if you say that the reason for keeping mangroves is so that you can get tourists to go to Florida, then you say, well, surely it will be more economical to get rid of the mangroves and put up a casino. And once you commit yourself to the economic arguments, I think you are no longer doing what's needed to defend the other creatures. The real point about making economic arguments in favour of conservation is that unless you have good economic arguments in favour of conservation, then you cannot practice conservation. But you must see the economics as a means to an end and not in an end in themselves, because otherwise the whole thing is far too vulnerable. The question of human beings being super intelligent, I take it to be self-evident, and I don't think anybody's ever doubted this, that human beings really are qualitatively different from other animals. And as good Darwinists, of course, we ought to be stressing the similarities, and one can go on stressing the similarities, and the more you look at other animals and the more you look at ourselves, the more you see what the similarities are. It nevertheless remains the case that human beings are unique. I mean, Robert Foley's lovely book, what was it called? Another Unique Species. But we are, as it were, very unique. We are more unique than the rest of them. And people give all kinds of reasons why this is the case, and they talk about our terrific intelligence and our language, which is underpinned by syntax, and our verbal dexterity, our speech, and the rest of it. And these all add up to explaining why we're different. But I just like, because I'm talking about natural history, just to make a sort of single statement, a sort of overall objective statement, that the real difference between us and other animals is that you can compare other animals to, as it were, calculating machines, and you can say that each of these other species is specialized to do one kind of, to solve one kind of problem, like an old-fashioned calculating machine. But the human being, as it were, is the world's first ever Turing machine. It's the one creature which can adapt itself to absolutely any problem.
It is the protean creature. I think if one was a sort of 1930s Frenchman, you would say we are the original existentialists. We can invent ourselves in any form we choose to invent ourselves, which we choose. And it's this single fact that makes us all powerful. But it's actually the particular modus operandi that we chose, the modus operandi of farming, which has caused us to have to become as numerous as we are, and to have the ecological dominance that we have, and indeed to change the entire ecological pattern of the whole world, so that there's no creature on this earth that doesn't exist except, as it were, under sufferance, because we allow it to, or because temporarily we can't get rid of it. The ecological uniqueness of human beings is demonstrated by the single fact that we have broken the ecological law which says that big, fierce animals are rare. And it's obvious why big, fierce animals are rare, because they need a great deal of space and because they need a great deal of resource. And, for example, tigers need anywhere between 10 and 100 square kilometres each, so there aren't many tigers in the world. Maybe at the height of tigerdom, maybe sometime in the Pleistocene, there might have been 1 million tigers, maybe more. Now there's something like 2,000. We outnumber tigers by something like 6 million to 1. Big, fierce animals are in general rare, but human beings are extremely common. They're among the biggest of all, the most numerous of all vertebrates. Yet we're among the biggest, yet we are the most efficient predators that have ever lived. I want to talk about human population because it's absolutely a key issue. The human population at the moment is rapidly approaching 6 billion. And that in itself is a fairly frightening figure, because one has to ask whether the world can sustain a population of 6 billion. Now the answer, if you look at the technology of farming, is unquestionably yes, if we did it properly. In other words, if farming systems of the world were actually geared to feeding human beings, then surely 6 billion would not be an overburdensome number to sustain. It is, however, the case that the agricultural systems of the world are not geared to feeding human beings. That is not actually their prime agenda. Their prime agenda is always to do something else, either to conform to the rules of GATT or to conform to the rules of the EEC, or to demonstrate that free enterprise works, or to demonstrate that collectivism works, but almost never is it geared to the feeding of human beings. I can think of a few exceptions. In the Second World War, for example, the agriculture of Britain was in fact geared to feeding the population, and even with the technology of the day, that proved to be possible. And I think in China, in the late 1950s and onwards under Mao Zedong, they did actually mobilize peasant farming for the purposes of feeding human beings, and they did demonstrate that it could be done using village-scale agriculture. But with those kind of ad hoc exceptions, you can say that agriculture simply isn't geared to feed human beings. And you can say, therefore, it's pretty obvious that we don't manage to feed 6 billion people well, and it's pretty obvious that that our attempts to feed 6 billion people even badly cannot be sustained. And I won't go into it because you know it already, but we are ruining the world's water at a fantastic rate, and we are removing the world's soil at a fantastic rate. And even the present 6 billion cannot be fed at the present level for very long in the present kind of ways that we're going about it. I was in Australia a couple of weeks ago, and Australia has become a terrifying place. And one says to oneself, it is an ecological miracle that a population that now amounts to only 15 million people, in other words, is really no bigger than London and the home counties, could have laid waste a country the size of the United States in such an astonishingly short space of time. But I don't know what's going to be happening, for example, in South Australia over the next few years, because there are seas under the ground, literal oceans under the surface of South Australia, which were there in the Miocene, and they're still there, the salt's still there. And because of irrigation, the salt is being brought to the surface, and there is now water coming to the surface, which is about 1.5 times as saline as the sea. And this is happening over hundreds and hundreds of square miles, and one just looks at the whole of South Australia and says, well, you know, what's going to happen to it, really, in the next few decades? My point is only that already we are making a pretty poor fist of feeding 6 billion people. However, The problem of feeding 6 billion people invites the comment, you ain't seen nothing yet, because what really matters is the rate of rise of the population. And the rate of rise of the population is actually quite difficult to pin down, because it's actually quite difficult to do accurate censuses. And even the United States, apparently, their latest census was said to be inaccurate by about 2 or 3%. There were 2 or 3% of the people they didn't manage to count, presumably the 2 or 3% who would have been sent home if they had managed to count them. But for one reason or another, people, censuses tend not to be accurate, so it's very hard to start talking about whether it's a 1.8 or a 1.9% increase at any one time. But the figures that get banded around are that the present rate of increase of the world's population is somewhere between 1.6 and 1.8%. Now, when Douglas Adams wrote his wonderful book, whose name's gone right out of my head, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, he said that the secret of the universe was the number 46. Well, the secret of the universe is not the number 46. The secret of the universe is the number 69.3. And don't ask me why, but there is a very nice mathematical demonstration of why it's such an important number. But the point is that if you take the number 69.3 and you divide it by the percentage increase in population per annum, then it will give you the number of years in which it will take for the population as a whole to double. So if you take the number 69.3 and you divide it by 1.8, you get a figure of roughly 40. And you can say, therefore, the human population will double at every 40 years if it continues to increase at the present rate. What this means is that by the year, if the population reaches 6 billion by 2000 AD, then it will reach 12 billion by 2040 AD, and it will reach 24 billion by 2080 AD. And it will reach 48 billion by 2120 AD, and it will reach 96 billion by 2160 AD. Now, there are people in the world who are very silly and who say things like, every birth is a glory to God. And that's just quite a nice way to look at babies once they're born, because once they're born, you have to look after them. But nobody, you have to be very, very, very silly indeed to think that the world can sustain 96 billion people. And yet that's the kind of population that would be reached by the second half of the 22nd century if we went on growing at the present rate. Now, there are also people in the world who think that these kind of dates are far too remote to be worth thinking about. But the fact of the matter is there are already something like 40,000 people in the Earth. I read this the other day in some piece of trivia, but there are already 40,000 people in the world who are centenarians. And the longevity of human beings is increasing the whole time, so we can say that by the end of the 21st century, there will be millions of people who are centenarians. In other words, you can say that there are already people living on this Earth right now, lying in their cots, just being born, who will still be around at the beginning of the 22nd century, and by that time, if the human population continues to rise at the present rate, then there would be 30 billion species, 30 billion people on Earth. Now, that is just a ludicrous number, I mean, absolutely ludicrous number. And nobody who has any sense at all can suggest that that kind of number is reachable. But that's what we would reach within the lifetimes of people now on Earth, if the present rate continues, the present rate percentage increase continues. There are other possible scenarios, and one could look to the other extreme scenario, and say something like this, that in the 1970s, apparently, the percentage rate of increase of the human population was about 2%. If it's true that it's now about 1.6, 1.8%, then this actually represents a fairly dramatic percentage loss, rate per percent per year loss. In other words, the percentage rate of increase is falling off, even though the absolute rate of increase is going up because the base number is bigger. However, if the percentage rate of increase is reducing, then this means that sooner or later, in fact, sooner actually, quite encouragingly, the rate of increase, percent rate of increase, will be zero, in which case the world population would stabilize. And there is one scenario which comes out of, I think, Princeton, where they think about this sort of thing quite deeply, that says that if the percentage rate of increase per year continues to fall at the rate at which it's been falling since the 1970s, it will reach zero by the middle of the 21st century, by which time the human population will be somewhere between 10 and 12 billion. If we assume that that kind of population is sustainable, then if you follow through these demographic projections and you make other kinds of assumptions, you come out with a picture that the human population would remain at about 10 to 12 billion for about 500 to 1,000 years. And then one can project that it would actually start to come down. And then one could say that people in 500 to 1,000 years' time can start to ask themselves, how low should the population really be? What's the desirable level? And I've asked various, I mean, anybody can have their own opinion, but I've asked various people what they think would be a reasonable figure. And Paul Ehrlich of Stanford, who's been writing about this kind of thing since the 1970s, said, well, he thinks that a world population of about 2 billion would be quite nice, which is the kind of population we had in the year 1900. And, you know, future people might decide to come down to that sort of level and then stabilize. And Michael Soule, who is one of the great prophets of conservation theory, says that in his opinion a world population of about 300 million might be quite nice, which was about the population at the time of Christ. Obviously, tremendous amount of guesswork involved in the population at the time of Christ, but that was roughly what people think it was. And as Michael points out, at that time, there were enough people in the world to have some very nice cities, there were enough people in the world to have some very nice cultural pursuits, and there was no shortage of genius. I mean, there were plenty of geniuses around at the time of Christ, including, I would say, Christ himself, but some people wouldn't. So, anyway, that is the good scenario, that actually the population goes up and hangs around and comes down again. Both worth discussing. One interesting, if the population takes the first route and we don't manage to get on top of it and it goes on growing at the present rate, then let us say we do get to somewhere between 25 and 30 billion by the end of the 21st century. No one with two brain cells would suggest that such a population is sustainable. It might be possible to peak at that, but one would say you aren't going to hold that population for more than a few months, because at that kind of population, with the kind of organization that one might envisage, one will be wasting the topsoil so fast and will be wasting the water so fast, polluting the water so fast, and that population cannot be sustainable. Therefore, it will crash. Once it crashes, one can say it's absolutely out of control. What you can also say is that the amount of damage done during the time when it's very, very high and then crashing will be so great that the world's carrying capacity will be reduced irreversibly, effectively irreversibly, to a level far below what it is now. One might envisage quite fanciful scenarios in which the human population is reduced to island populations dotted here and there, and that would be quite interesting, because then one might say to oneself, well, once you've got smaller populations which are isolated or quasi-isolated, then one might again begin to think in terms of Darwinian, genuine neo-Darwinian evolution rebeginning, and people being, as it were, re-evolving genetically, the gene pool changing over time. Of course, nobody would be silly enough to suppose that it would, as it were, carry on where it left off 8 million years ago and that we'd go on getting brighter, because one might well find in this future scenario that the brain, which is a very energetic organ, would be actually rather superfluous, and we might lose our brains in the way that island birds lose their wings. This is all fancy. But it's not as fanciful as all that. And the real point is that if we carry on as we are, then by the beginning of the 22nd century, we can envisage this amazing crash. And that is within the lives of people who are still, lifetimes of people who are now alive. Even if we go down the second route, and by this inexorable process, the rate of increase drops so that we get to this level of 10 to 12 billion by the middle of the century and then carry on, we can still say two things about it. One is that it would be the biggest demographic change that's occurred in the history of the human species for 100,000 years, ever since our own species, Homo sapiens, began. Certainly the biggest demographic change that's occurred within the last 10,000 years. And it will be happening within 50 years' time, when some people in this room will still be alive. If we go down the pessimistic route and we reach this huge level and then come crashing down and take everything else with us, then I think one could say this would be the biggest mass extinction event, the biggest ecological reversal since, really, the end of the dinosaurs, the KT boundary, when that whole swathe of animals disappeared. And this is within our lifetime. And when I sort of think about things like this, excuse me, I wonder why anybody ever bothers to consider anything else. I mean, the fact of the matter is, no, it's true. I mean, even things that are shocking and horrible and enormous, like you know, the war in Yugoslavia or the Middle East, are actually dwarfed by comparison with this kind of scenario, which is hovering just a few decades away. And yet people don't talk about it, not really. Every now and again it pops up in an international conference and people talk about it for a few minutes and weird people like environmental correspondents write a few leaders and then it disappears again from public perception, public discussion. I'm not 100% sure of the reasons. I suppose we can all speculate. One is that it seems to be so far out of the compass of politicians that politicians don't bother to discuss it. It doesn't go within the normal compass of politics. Another is that the whole issue of population and population control, in inverted commas, has many, many awful connotations which people prefer to avoid. And even the rather trivial reason that in many respects it's, politically incorrect, that's it, yes. That to discuss it, because it's sometimes seen as an attack by rich people upon the third world, or an attack upon Islam, or an attack upon the freedom of women, something like that. And for this kind of reason, which, by comparison with what's at stake, is trivial, for that kind of reason, the argument gets pushed aside, and then it resurfaces again 20 years later, and it's worse than it was. But it's not going to go away. There are some interesting little connotations of population which I really can't resist. One is the very, very encouraging thing, that if you think seriously about how population can be reduced, there's really only two routes. Either you increase the death rate or you decrease the birth rate. And the thing that everybody says is acceptable, and the only thing that everybody admits is acceptable, is the decreasing of the birth rate. Now, the very, very nice point, which I think is a nice point, is that all the, as it were, malignant or malign solutions that people come up with apropos population fail. Mega war fails. It kills a few people, or lots of people in the short term, but then the population bounces back. Epidemic fails. High infant mortality fails. High infant mortality is the most, well, obviously it's the most horrible thing, but in addition to being a horrible thing, it is also so biologically inefficient that a woman should get pregnant and give birth to a baby and then the baby dies. I mean, it's just a tremendous waste besides anything else. On the other hand, the kinds of solutions that people come up with that might actually succeed are all benign. For example, if you know your babies are going to live, then you don't have so many. If you live in a society where it's possible for you as a woman to do things other than have children and still have status, then you don't have so many children. Affluent people in general don't have so many children. If you have a pension, then you don't have so many children because you don't need children to look after you in your old age. So all the measures that could, in the long term, as it were, reduce population are benign, and one can say that all the malign measures, all the sort of fascist measures, don't have a hope in hell. And I quite like the notion that in this context, the sort of utilitarian arguments are actually the nice arguments. It doesn't always work out that way. It does in that particular case. Excuse me. There's another kind of thought which when populations start to go down, when birth rates start to go down, as they have gone down, for example, in recent years in places like West Germany, then this means, obviously, in the short term you have fewer babies, in the slightly longer term you have fewer children, and in the slightly longer term you have fewer adolescents and young men and young women. When you have fewer young men and young women, lots and lots of people start getting worried. Trade unionists get worried because there's nobody to do the work to pay the pensions of the people who have already retired. bosses get worried because they haven't got a young labour force, and there's nothing worse than not having a young labour, having to pay all these old people who want far too much money and have already lost all their energy. Terrible thing, much better to get some young people. Generals get very worried because they can no longer raise a tremendous army and send them off. So everybody gets worried when the population becomes skewed towards old age. And then you get outbursts of pronatalism for one reason or another. And we saw an outburst of pronatalism in China in the 1950s and 60s when Mao Zedong wanted an army of, I don't know, 100 million so that he could just walk over, so that he could defend himself perhaps. There's an outbreak of pronatalism in Malaysia at the moment. People want more people so that they can defend themselves against, as it were, the other Asian countries. Ceausescu was a proud pro-natalist. He wanted more Romanians around the place. Peculiar things. After the in the 1930s, I was told, you know, American intellectuals were very against the idea of having large families because for precisely the kind of reasons I'm talking about now, they saw the dangers of overpopulation. But when the Kennedys became fashionable in the 50s and 60s, even people who were non-Catholics started having big families because it was fashionable to have big families. You suddenly, for all sorts of peculiar reasons, get these little outbreaks of pronatalism. And I don't think I mentioned the fact, did I mention the fact that Michael Soule referred to the very, very long period of 500 to 1,000 years in which the human population will be very, very high in this benign scenario. He referred to this period as the demographic winter. But I heard the other day one of the French presidents. It wasn't the most recent, it was a previous one, and I can't remember. I get my French presidents mixed up, really. But he used the expression demographic winter not to refer to a period in which the human population was very high, but to refer to the fact that at that time, French people were having fewer children than Kenyans and fewer people than Egyptians and fewer people than most Muslims. And therefore, he said, there will be a relative shortage of French people, God forbid. And he said, and this is a demographic winter. I don't know, anyway, whatever it is. Amazing. So you've got a nice little, you've got encouragement of pronatalism in France. So the notion that, as it were, increasing affluence and all the rest of it drives us inexorably towards a reduced population doesn't necessarily apply. There's all sorts of wild cards in there. I've talked about population too long, so I'll talk about something else now. The reason, why is it that human beings have got to be so amazingly numerous? And the reason is farming. And the reason that farming has this effect is because the whole point of farming is to, as it were, expropriate as many calories and other resources as possible from the environment, and in a very sort of rational and orderly sort of way, direct them towards your own species. And whereas, let us say, a rhinoceros living in a state of nature might need a square kilometer to browse, less space than a carnivore, but still a huge amount of space. Human beings, because they clear away all the other plants apart from the ones they want, and they nurture the ones they do want, could theoretically get by on a few acres. In fact, a calculation has been done to show that one human being could survive on something like 100 square meters if only we knew how to harness photosynthesis more efficiently than we do. But the point is that with agriculture, fairly obviously, because you direct all the resources towards you, you can increase your population. There's another very, very nice twist to this, which is to do with, I think it's to do with game theory. I wish John Maynard Smith was here for various reasons, because then he could tell me that it wasn't, but since he can't, he isn't. So, but the point is that if you are an ordinary hunter-gatherer, then actually it pays you to be lazy. And I'm not saying, and if you look at hunter-gatherers, you find that most of the time the chaps who do the hunting are extremely lazy. They spend most of their time sitting around, talking, telling stories, etc., etc., etc. Now, it may well have been that in the history of the world there had been hunter-gatherers who weren't lazy, who were terribly energetic, you know, get-up-and-go people, yuppies, going out hunting. But natural selection would not have favoured these people, because if you are too energetic as a hunter, then you destroy your resource base. And one can imagine that very energetic hunters would have been wiped out. And I think there's lots of evidence of human populations all over the world. Well, I say there's lots of evidence. Rob Furley will tell me there isn't, but one assumes there might be. Because they have over over exploited their resource base by being too energetic. However, if you're a farmer, there is a total change in the logistics of the case, because the whole point of farming is that it rewards hard work. And if you want more food, you simply work harder. And this means that a human being who elects to be a farmer is ecologically quite different kind of a beastie from a human being who elects to be a hunter, because the first one is if he's going to survive in the long term, has got actually to be lazy. The hunter has got to be lazy, whereas the farmer can be as ecological, can be as energetic and as exploitative as he chooses, and becomes a quite different kind of beastie. I should just emphasize that when I say natural selection in this case, I don't mean to say natural selection in the sort of neo-Darwinian sense that you're getting selection of genes. I don't mean that the people who elect to be farmers are genetically different from the people who elect to be hunters. I'm just saying that natural selection, as it were, operates as a process, and that the people who choose the modus operandi of farming succeed where the people who choose the modus operandi of hunting don't. Right. Excuse me. A very, very interesting question, obviously an interesting question, is when did farming begin? The conventional notion, which I think is probably 19th century, but again I will be corrected, but anyway, it's a traditional conventional notion, is that farming began in the Middle East round about 10,000 years ago, I beg your pardon, and the evidence for that is that in the Middle East about 10,000 years ago, you find evidence that the grains and so on that the people were eating were different from the wild ones, and therefore, one says, presumably they must have been domesticated, they've been changed by domestication. The seeds, for example, are bigger. Later, one sees signs of animals which seem to have been domesticated, the sign there usually being, for example, that they're smaller, or for example, that when they're slaughtered, they tend to be, I'm not sure whether they're all supposed to be the same age or all different ages, but for some reason the age at which they're killed is different from the age at which they would be killed if they were being killed randomly in the wild. And by this kind of clue, one says, this is when agriculture began. This is when traditional people said, this is where agriculture began. Now I think, and a lot of other people think, that this of course is that very, very simple scenario, which nobody now, of course, nobody serious entertains, but was entertained previously, is absolute nonsense. And the reason it's absolute nonsense is that when you find something, the archaeological record is extremely spotty, extremely sparse, so is the fossil record. And when you find anything in the fossil record, or when you find something in the archaeological record, all you can say is that it must have been around by that time. But what you could also say, almost certainly, is that by the time it appears in the fossil record or the archaeological record, it must have been common, it must have been well established. A very, very nice example of this actually was a recent paper in Nature where Robert Martin was talking about the origin of primates. And he says the oldest primate fossils are about 45 million years old. And people have always said, well, you know, that's when the primates began, sort of Eocene times. But in fact, at the time they first appeared, they are already extremely diverse, and secondly, one knows that the number of primate fossils that appear in the fossil record is extremely small, like sort of 3%. And from this kind, both these kind of facts together and putting a bit of maths to it, which again I won't begin to go into, you can calculate that actually the probable age of the beginning of the primates was probably about 80 million years ago. In other words, the primates had begun as bona fide identifiable primates probably about 15 million years before the dinosaurs disappeared. And I like the idea of primates sitting up in trees and dinosaurs sticking their heads up and wallop on the nose. But anyway, the point is that the farming appeared 10,000 years ago in the archaeological record. All one can say is that it must have appeared sometime before that. Now when? Well, John Yellen, who is a jolly nice chap from American Academy of Sciences, has this nice notion, based on various ideas, but nice notion that probably farming in the broad sense began in tropical forests round about 30,000 years ago. People were just sticking things in the ground, and why shouldn't they? I mean, they were modern people, they knew perfectly well how plants grew. Why shouldn't they have been encouraging the various plants that grew around them? But I think you can think more broadly than that and define farming broadly, as they say, sensu lato, isn't that what? Yes, right. Define farming very broadly and say, look, what farming really is when a predator latches on to some prey species, whether it's a plant, whether it's an animal, and doesn't simply eat it up, but does something to it in such a way that it propagates that thing which it is consuming. In other words, one can see farming in the broad sense simply as a symbiotic relationship which a predator may well have with a prey species. And when you define it broadly, you see that farming in this broad sense is something that a whole range of different animals do. For example, fruit bats and orangutans spread the seeds of the fruit trees that they feed upon. And if you take away the orangutans, the woods, the forests in which they live become much less diverse because the seeds are no longer being spread. I came across an absolutely wonderful example of, as it were, farming carried out by animals when I was in Australia. And there's this lovely, it's an awful bird, but it's called the bell bird, and it makes this bell-like noise all the time. And it's one of the 62 odd species of honey eater. And honey eaters eat the eucalyptus trees, and they have sap coming up, like all trees do. And feeding on the sap are these little bugs, nymphs, the nymphs of bugs, called psyllids. And they sit on the bark and they cover themselves in a little coat of sugar, which forms a little hard carapace over the top, like a mealybug, only not mealy but sugary. And many, many birds feed on these little sugary caps, and they feed on the nymphs inside at the same time. However, the bell bird is a very, very clever bird, much cleverer than all the others, and it comes along and it prizes off the caps, but it doesn't usually eat the psyllids. And the psyllid nymph will then grow itself another cap, and the bell bird will come along later and eat the other cap. When most honey eaters feed upon the psyllid bugs on eucalyptus trees, they do the eucalyptus trees enormous favour because they get rid of all the psyllid bugs, all the parasites. When bell birds feed upon psyllid bugs, they encourage the growth of the bugs, not because they are prizing them off and eating the sugary coats, but because in addition to doing that, they are extremely aggressive and they fight off any other bird that comes within the vicinity. And you actually see, I'm told, aerial combats, the bell birds actually physically fighting the other birds that come in. Now what the bell bird is doing is two things which are essential ingredients of farming. It is, on the one hand, simply harvesting its prey without destroying its prey, and on the other hand, it is protecting it, it's carrying out crop protection. Now, what I'm suggesting is that this kind of relationship between predator and prey is very, very common in animals. And it's seen among anthropoid apes, for example, among orangutans. And I bet if you looked for it among chimpanzees, you'd find it as well. You'd find crop protection of a kind, for example. And what it seems to me is that one can say that for hominids in the narrow sense, i.e. Homo and Australopithecus and Ardipithecus, just these three. Among them, I would just lay bets. I mean, you know, I can't lose this bet, but I mean, I would lay bets that they were farmers in this broad sense from the very beginning. And then, if you admit that this is at least a possibility, there are two interesting questions that follow up from that. One is, at what point did this farming in the very, very broad sense become ecologically important? At what point did it really start to transform the fortunes of the hominids? And at what point, therefore, did it start to be bad news for all the other animals that were around the hominids as the hominids became more successful? And also, in a sense, at what point did human beings become aware that they were farming? Now, the first question, at what point did the farming in this broad sense become ecologically important, significant, is right from the very beginning. Because the real point about farming, when you're practicing it in this sort of, you know, this broad sense, is not that it necessarily tremendously increases your intake of calories or tremendously increases your intake of protein, but that it broadens your prey base and it enables you to hang on in niches from which you would otherwise be excluded in particular years. You see the point that whatever's happening to the surroundings, if you've got your little tiny amount of food in the bank that you are protecting or you are planting, this will help you to keep going when the others are suffering and having to move out. And you only need a very, very small percentage advantage, tiny percentage advantage, to make a huge difference. An analogy in this is really, I think, domestic cats living in the suburbs. Domestic cats living in the suburbs are very, very bad news for small birds. And the reason they're very bad news for small birds is that they don't rely on small birds. They feed on kitty cat, and they've killed small birds for a hobby. And what this means is that when the population of small birds goes down, the population of cats doesn't go down. The population of cats stays nice and steady because they're feeding on kitty cat. The population of small birds goes down. And the cats are always there waiting to knock them on the head. If you are some poor old creature like a northern lynx, this is a sort of computer game, and you're feeding exclusively on, say, snowshoe hares, the population of snowshoe hare goes up, and then the population of lynxes goes up, and then the population of snowshoe hares goes down, the population of lynxes goes down, and the hares goes up, and the lynx go up, and then the hare. I hope you realize what tremendous coordination is involved. So the fortunes of the predator in a case like that depend entirely upon the fortunes of the prey. Whereas if you've got a very, very broad prey base, and if you've got a very, and if furthermore you are maintaining your prey base, even by a little bit of farming, then your population doesn't go down, and you can continue to attack the wild, the prey animals around you, even after they have got rare. And my point is that even a very, very tiny amount of farming, in this broad sense, makes a terrific difference to the robustness and the survival and the viability of the animals that are practicing, and is very, very bad news for any other animal that is not actually being benefited by the predator, but is not part of the symbiotic relationship, in fact, but is simply sitting on the margins. So the real argument, the real point, the answer to the question, when did it become ecologically significant, is right from the very beginning. The next really interesting question is, well, when did, as it were, the apish farming in the broad sense of Australopithecines become a sort of conscious farming of agricultural human beings? And the answer to that is, I don't know, of course, but it's simply part of the much broader question of when did apes become humans? And there must have been, whatever the transition was that took place over about 1 million years, as far as the fossil record shows, between being sort of fairly apish and being fairly human, the farming was part of this, so that by the time maybe you got to the Upper Paleolithic, which is when the archaeological record shows that you've got a terrific variety of tools, and it shows, it seems to suggest that human beings were getting truly modern and they were truly communicating. By that time, it seems to me, people were probably already farming in the broad sense at quite a significant level. Now, the very nice thing about this whole theory, no, it's not a theory, it's a hypothesis, it's an idea, conjecture. The very nice thing about it is that it's absolutely devoid of evidence. Because if you found evidence, the prediction would be that if you found evidence, it's already too late, you see? I mean, the whole point is that the farming practiced in this broad way, in the farming practice, although it is ecologically very important, actually doesn't show up. Because what are you doing? You're simply increasing the frequency of certain plants at certain times, or you're guiding animals into gullies or whatever. But you're not doing anything that will show up in the paleontological or archaeological record. And if you were doing that, if it did show up, then you would have to say, well, whatever it was, it must have started a long time before that. How then should we read the unquestionable, at least I believe it's unquestionable, of course I'll be told later that it isn't, but the unquestionable appearance of genuine, I mean, unmistakable farming artifacts in the Neolithic 10,000 years ago? What was happening then? What how do we read that? Well, I reckon this... This is again, another conjecture. But the notion is that this represents the point at which human beings who were practicing farming, we might say, for a hobby, became human beings who were doing it as a main source of... as the main base for their economy. And the question is, why did that happen? Let me just add a few points before I answer the question, why did it happen? One of the problems with the, as it were, the traditional scenario that agriculture arose in the Middle East 10,000 years ago and then spread, one of the troubles is that it seemed to appear in other places around the world at various intervals afterwards, and it's very difficult sometimes to connect the other places with the Middle East, so that it turned up a bit later in the Indus Valley, and it turned up in India, it turned up in China, it turned up several times in America independently. And people said, well, you know, did news of agriculture sort of travel, as it were, from mouth to mouth, like a sound wave through a symbol like this? Or did people wander out from the Middle East and take the word with them, you know, sort of Neolithic extension workers? I mean, which was it? And the point is that if you assume that people were farming from a very, very young age, a very, very early time, say 40,000 years ago, or 30,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago, then you don't have to have any such notion. All you have to say is, look, all happened in these various places around the world at different times. Was that for some reason or another, and probably a different reason in each place, the agriculture became, crossed the dividing line between being a hobby and being the main source of the economy? All you then have to do is ask, why did it stop being a hobby and become serious? And as I think, as why I say that the details almost undoubtedly would be different from place to place, but there are some generalizations. The generalization is that it wouldn't become serious. It really wouldn't become serious unless the people were pushed into it. In other words, they had to be forced into it, and unless there was opportunity. And this is a generalization that you can apply to all evolution. You don't get evolutionary change unless there's the possibility of evolutionary change, or no, unless there's pressure pushing you towards change, and neither do you get the change unless there's the opportunity. So what? Let us take the Middle East. What was the pressure? What was the opportunity? Well, the opportunity is the same opportunity that you see throughout the world, that there were plants and animals around of a kind that can be domesticated. And it simply is the case that not every animal and not every plant lends itself to serious domestication. Certainly not every animal. I mean, there are 30-odd species of deer, and to my knowledge, deer have never been seriously domesticated until the 1970s. I mean, they were kept in parks, and people chased them with dogs and horses, but they never seriously domesticated until the 70s, because not until the 70s did people have the technology to keep abreast of an animal like this, which is so skittish and so strong, and has a very variable social structure, so that you can't really just direct them around the place in the way that you can sheep and cattle. And nobody, to my knowledge, has ever seriously a domesticated antelope. People are mucking about nowadays with elands, but they resist. And yet there are 70-odd species of antelope, and yet they've never really been domesticated. The handful of animals that have been domesticated have all got a few things in common. Like sheep have a natural tendency to follow. Pigs have a natural tendency to be commensal. I mean, I've been in India where wild pigs come out of the forest and fossick around in the evening and go away again. And you know, there is a notion that really domestic animals are the ones that gave themselves up. And the ones that were tame by nature were the ones that were taken up, and they are the ones, of course, that reproduced. You know, it's just that you become successful by being domestic. If you're an animal, it's not that you get yourself domesticated. And there are a whole number of animals that don't lend themselves to this, and if you happen to live in a place where the species don't lend themselves to this, then you don't do agriculture. And the Australian Aborigines never did agriculture in the modern sense, and nobody's ever shown how to tame the kangaroo. Serious point. Right, so you have to have the right plants, you have to have the right animals. The other things that really worked in favour of agriculture are any plant which is annual, which has nice big seeds. So in the Middle East, you've got barley and wheat, and in the in Americas, you've got maize, and you've got quinoa, which is a kenopod, and you've got amaranth, which is one of the amaranthaceae, and so on. And wherever you have these big seeds which grow locally, you're likely to get these things growing up. This is the opportunity. But I think these are trivial points. I think the real point is, the whole point about agriculture is what I said earlier, that it increases the biological success, the reproductive success of the creatures that are practicing it. If you increase the reproductive success of the animals that are practicing it, then of course the population goes up, that's what it means. If the population goes up, then the option simply to do agriculture as a hobby becomes reduced. Because unless you farm, if your population has gone up, then you can't live. And there's a third component, which the more you farm, the more you hunt other creatures, and the more high your population is, the more you affect other creatures around you in the manner of the domestic cat affecting the local birds, the more it becomes less of an option to do other things like hunting, because you've destroyed your other prey base. And so it seems to me you get a sort of vicious circle arising, where a little bit of farming raises the population, and that causes you to farm more, and that raises the population, and that causes you to farm more, and so on. You get a vortex. And all you see around the world where agriculture springs up is not a spontaneous invention, but these little vortices arising as the population gets to a point where it becomes necessary. However, I think in the Middle East there's a lovely little story. It's a just-so story, but I think it's very, very nice. And it's not my idea, of course, no. It comes from a chap called Juris Zarins of the Southwestern Missouri State University, which I'm sure is a very, very fine establishment. But this is a description of why, in particular, agriculture arose in the Middle East at the time it did. And he uses references to biblical myths, the notion being that although the myths of Genesis, in particular, were written down, let us say, 1600 BC, that kind of time, they could well refer to times that were many, many thousands of years before. And there's evidence, for example, from Australia that some of the myths are thousands of years old. There are places that Aborigines refer to that are now well under the sea, that were known not to have been under the sea in the time of the last ice age, 8,000 years ago. So the idea that myths can be several thousand years old is not foolish at all. But here is a little quote from Genesis 2:10-14. And this is another first, because it's the first time the Old Testament has ever been read at a Darwin seminar. And Helena tells me the last. This is the authorized version, the King James version, so it's rather fine. And a river went out of Eden to water the garden. Now this is Eden. And from thence it was parted and became into four heads. The name of the first is Pison, that it is which compasseth the whole land of Havilah where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good, there is Delium and the onyx stone. And the name of the second river is Gihon. The same is it that compasseth the whole land of Ethiopia. And the name of the third river, is Hiddekel. That is which goeth towards the east of Assyria, and the fourth river is Euphrates. Now, according to Zarins, the Hiddekel is the Tigris, and the other two, the Gihon and the Pison, are two little wadis these days, but possibly in those days they were perfectly good rivers. And what he did was to identify these rivers and then to trace them and see where they came out. And the confluence of the rivers is nicely out in the Persian Gulf. Now the nice point is that at the time that the last ice age ended, the Persian Gulf wasn't the Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf was a lovely coastal plain. And it must have been an estuarine plain. It would have been an estuarine plain, of course, and it was flat. And estuarine plains, absolutely the best place in the world to live if you're a human being or an animal. Deer come down and gazelles come down and there are clams and there are birds and there are fish. And life is very, very easy and very, very nice. And I'm not just romancing here because, well, certainly when I was in Australia, I was told by a very good anthropologist of how wonderful it is if you're an Aborigine living in Cape York, where the same kind of conditions obtain. And the notion is, and this is the notion, that Eden was a folk memory of these times when these people lived on this coastal plain and hunters and gatherers and had a little bit of cultivation on the side, a little bit of horticulture, and frankly had a wonderful time. And then the ice age ended and the sea rose, and when the sea rose it rose 600 feet at the end of the last ice age, and it obliterated about a third of the land area over the whole land. And it obliterated the coastal shelves, which are very big and very flat, and it flooded the Persian Gulf. And all the people were forced to move inland. And there are these lovely myths from around Mesopotamia, about 1600 BC, which are obviously contemporary with Genesis, but not written by the same people, which refer to the dangers of overpopulation. And one can imagine all these people crowding in on this space. And they are in the classic bind where now, because the population is high and it's been forcibly compressed in this case, they are actually obliged to start farming, whereas previously they've been doing it only for fun. Previously they were doing a bit of horticulture. Now they're into serious farming. And they don't like it. They don't like it one little bit, because actually it's a hideous way to make a living. And I just think that that lovely line, when God, if I mention the name, throws Adam out of the Garden of Eden, and he says, in the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread. Isn't that a wonderful line? In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread. And people have been sweating in their faces ever since because arable farming is absolutely hideous. And yet, once the population gets beyond a certain point, and once the wild animals have been swept aside, that is the only option. I've more or less overrun my time, haven't I? And I've got a few more things I wanted to say. Excuse me. Anyway, that, in my modest opinion, is how agriculture came into being. And once it had come into being, because of the way it is, because of the way it just focuses calories into the people who are practicing it, because it rewards hard work, the population since the time when it became serious, and let's say it really did become serious 10,000 years ago, the population has just zoomed up like that, and it zoomed up in the way that I've said. I just want to spend the last 10 minutes talking about the conservation of other species, because this is the thing that really interests me. And I have quite a lot of contact with this whole issue because I get quite involved with zoos. And one of the things is that, of course, the point about zoos, as my think the point about zoos, is that they actually breed populations of, well, you can call them wild animals even when they're captive. They're not domestic animals. They breed viable populations of wild animals. Now, one of the things that I found recently, and particularly in this conference I was in Australia, is that the whole notion of breeding animals in captivity seems again to have become politically incorrect, even in zoos. So you get very, very good zoo people, very dedicated, saying things like, well, there's no point approaching conservation at the level of habitat, of simply breeding individual species. We have to protect entire habitats. And they say things like, you know, if we protect an entire habitat, we will protect all the species that live in it. Whereas if you just protect if you breed individual species, you will only save a handful. And there are various answers to that. And because I'm running out of time, I'm going to curtail the answers. But one of the answers that seems to me to be rather shocking is this notion that for many animals, habitat protection is actually no longer an option, even if you do the best that can be done. And of course, we never do the best that can be done. But even if we do the best that can be done, it's no longer an option for some animals. It's no longer an option, for example, for tigers. You will not preserve tigers in the wild purely by habitat protection. And the point comes back to the fact that they really do need, let us say 10, let us say 100, depending on the terrain, square kilometres of territory each, plus the fact that no population of animals can be considered viable unless it contains at least several hundred individuals. And people generally, as a ballpark figure, people say you need about 500 animals of a given kind in the wild, or that population is not going to be viable in the long term. And if you say you need 500 tigers, and they each need between 10 and 100 square kilometres, then you say, unless you've got an area the size of Yorkshire, you are not in the business of conserving tigers in the wild. And if you ask the question, where is there an area the size of Yorkshire which is dedicated to tigers, which doesn't have cattle, which doesn't have villages, the answer is nowhere. It's rubbish. I mean, you know, there might be a few places knocking around Sumatra, but the sword is hanging over Sumatra because there are efforts to increase its population, and the Japanese have bought the forest and so on and so on and so on. So it's just not an option for that animal. One's beginning to say it's probably not an option anymore for the Asian elephant, and so on and so on and so on. So one begins, and then there's another point that the best one does in the way of habitat protection for animals at the moment is to create national parks. And there's this sort of vain idea or vainglorious idea that a national park is conserved in perpetuity. But just because a government now decides that it's going to say that this is a national park in perpetuity, absolutely does not guarantee that it's going to last more than 10 years or 50 years or 100 years. And in a sense, why should it? I mean, Tom Paine pointed out at the end of the 18th century, there's absolutely no reason why any government should have a right to say, or any population, people, should have a right to say what future society should do. So in a sense, we have no right to say that a national park will be a national park in perpetuity. And then you look at the realities of national parks, and you see there are national parks in Sumatra, for example, which are national parks in name, except there doesn't happen to be any trees there. Lots of cattle, sometimes. Lots of grass, perhaps. Lots of dust. But no trees, although it might be called a national park, it's a forest and so on. And in many, many national parks already, there are more cattle than there are wild animals. As it were, everybody knows that, and they just don't talk about it very much. Then the last point, I mean, there are dozens of points I could make, but the last sort of point one might make is that the greenhouse effect is real. There's absolutely no doubt that that animals in the past have survived over the last few tens, hundreds of thousands of years by migrating huge different distances north and south. I mean, thousands of miles north and south. I used to have a caravan in Yorkshire, and there was a cave nearby, and in the cave contained fossils of reindeer and also fossils of hippopotamus, and that was rather wonderful. You know, the reindeer were going south to escape the ice, and the hippopotamus were going north in the interglacial periods. And unless they'd been able to move these hundreds and thousands of miles, they simply wouldn't have survived. Now, if the greenhouse effect starts to bite, and even if it doesn't, and we simply go into it, continue the phase of ice ages and interglacials, then the animals which are in the national parks are simply going to be trapped. And one says, well, the only way they're going to survive is if you arrange for them to have huge corridors so they can move north and south. A few tiny concluding remarks, all very curtailed this now, but never mind. It does seem to me that if habitat protection is going to be serious, let us go back to Mr. and Mrs. Andrews. Right, there we are. Let's go back to being able to see. If you're serious about habitat protection, then I think you really have to think of the world as you have to think of the world as a whole. You have to think in terms of it being a mosaic. You have to think in terms of it being areas of wilderness, areas of extensive farming, areas of intensive farming, areas of cities. You have to think of the wild areas being linked by corridors, and so somehow you have to link the corridors and you have to link the cities. Probably you just have to put the roads on stilts, that sort of thing. But the thing has to be thought of as a whole. The kind of farming which has to justify itself is not the intensive farming, which is in general benign because it uses less space, but the extensive farming, which paradoxically is what conservationists tend to like, you know, the pastoral type farming spread all over the place. But the point is, if you're serious about habitat protection, you have to do it that way. On the other hand, if you take even the best scenario of what's going to happen to human population, the Michael Soule notion of the demographic winter, 500 to 1,000 years, you really have to think in terms of taking as many animals as possible effectively out of the wild and keeping them on hold, keeping them in breeding populations, and then at some future time reconstructing, when the population is going down again, reconstructing what some kind of semblance of wilderness, and perhaps introducing enough animals and with enough space so that, as it were, the process of Darwinian evolution can continue in these beasties as it did in the past. And here is the point of this, really, that these people, or people like this, they conceived of landscape as a place that they owned, and they were demonstrating their mastery over it. And they weren't knocking the life out of it, as it were, the way the French did. They weren't creating Versailles here with you know, knock gardens and all the rest of it. What they were doing, they were regarding landscape really in the way that one might regard a mettlesome horse, in that you give it its head, you show how strong it is, you show how wild and powerful it is, and yet you show that you're in command. And that is sort of quite nice, except that the English gentry and the landowners in general who have been in charge of the English landscape for the last 1,000 years or so have completely obliterated any kind of animal from Britain which is the slightest bit inconvenient, so that the aurochs is gone, and the beaver is gone, and the wolf is gone, and if there were ever lynx here, the lynx have gone. They damn nearly got rid of the otter, they damn nearly got rid of the peregrine, they got rid entirely of the white-tailed eagle, which was bigger than the golden eagle, and there was the commonest eagle in Britain. They got rid of the white-tailed eagle from Scotland at the same time they got rid of the crofters, and for the same reason, to make way for sheep. And in fact, you could say that, as it were, the good old English gentry who have been in charge of the English landscape and regard themselves as great stewards have probably got the worst conservation record of any group of people in the world, although the Australians are catching them up very fast. What we have to do is to borrow some of their vigour and take control of landscapes in the way that they did. But our ideal is not to show that we own it, not to show how great we are, but our ideal is to recreate as much biodiversity as is possible in the future and allow genuine natural processes to continue. And to do that, we actually have to learn to love wilderness, which actually nobody in the Western world has ever managed to do. Thank you very much. That's all.
Okay, so we've got 15-20 minutes for questions. So if you could, when you're recognized by the speaker, if you could give your name and affiliation.
Peter Sosu, UCL. You raised some interesting questions about population problems, in particular problems that might occur in the future, where this say 100 years' time. Now, it's interesting, there's a lot of question about what extent you care about what happens over that sort of time scale, related to what economists call social discount rates. Clearly, from your talk, you do care about what's going to be happening in 100 years' time. I think I do too, and I hope most possible people would. If you look at the standard economics literature, the social discount rate says that you should devalue the future of what should be devalued. If you adopt, say, a social discount rate of 5%, it says that what happens next year is worth less than what happens this year by 5%, that amounts to every 14 years things being half their value. Mm. If you then look at what happens 100 years from there, works out the future is worth less than what happens in 1% of the present. So if you adopt a conventional economics argument that's fairly public economists do, I think it looks like descriptive and here on the resources, if you actually believe that, then you end up concluding it doesn't matter at all or what happens in 100 years' time. So if you want to make people care about it, don't need to be challenging the
yes, it's just extremely bad way of looking at the world and extremely bad way of thinking about the future. It also seems to be very unbiological, doesn't it? I mean, shouldn't one be thinking about one's genes and all that kind of stuff? I don't know. I just threw that in. But I agree with you, yes. It's not good. Actually, yeah. Sorry, Jonathan. Didn't you say something, Jonathan?
Well, no, not related to that, but I just wanted to ask you, Colin, you used the word, you used the masculine when you were describing the first farmers.
Mm.
Is it not possible that the first farmers were feminine?
I'd say it was not only possible, but likely.
Yes.
I was using he in the broad sense.
Yes. But I think it is
You're right.
An important point.
Yeah, it's very, absolutely. Because they would have been the first horticulturalists, and that would have been the one that really counted. Yeah.
David.
I agree with a great deal of what you said about the great antiquity of what I would call farming, which you do. I'm going to call it something like farming information. Never. Let's not get into this matter. But it does seem to me there's something of a contradiction in the general scene of painting, in the sense that although we can acknowledge that many, perhaps most parts of the world, humans from the remotest antiquity have had a selective impact on the environment. They have manipulated both plants and animals for their own ends. I have no argument with that. But it doesn't seem to be to follow from that that you would expect, therefore, to have agriculture in the more developed sense when the majority of the population becomes dependent on it, springing up all over the place. This is what many people, of course, were arguing in the 60s and 70s. And if we can actually pick up the signatures for that type of agriculture in the agriculture, and it seems to me that's precisely what we don't see. What we do see is that there are relatively few, in my view, extremely few, situations where the conjunction of circumstances is such that you get a population, and I agree with you, push into dependence on agriculture. I happen to take the conventional view that this, we have the earliest evidence of this happening in Western Asia around 10,000 years ago. I think it may have happened a couple of times in Eastern Asia. America's more complicated. Let's not get into that. And it seems to me what you were saying about opportunity, especially with regard to the animals, in a sense also undermines your general picture, because as you rightly said, there are relatively few animals, particularly animals, that do offer themselves, so to speak, for domestication. And it looks very much as if this particular style of intervention around the world happened in a relatively concentrated area in Western Asia, possibly only there, perhaps once or twice in the Americas. So isn't there some sort of contradiction at the heart of what you're saying?
why? I'm sorry, I don't see why.
Well, you were attacking the conventional view that agriculture began with the service 10,000 years ago and then largely spread. I'm saying that does seem to be the picture, provided you dissociate the notion of great agricultural manipulation from the notion which you, I think, characterized rightly of situations in which humans become dependent on agriculture as they may life support system.
But why would you want to? Why would you want to make this dissociation? That's why. I mean, for example, with America, I don't honestly see how anything could have spread from the Middle East to the Americas.
I wouldn't wish to argue that, but I think within Europe, Asia, and probably Africa, I think, Minister, you can view the whole phenomenon as far as we currently understand of the origin of this full commitment to agriculture and progressive diminution of dependence on wild resources as happening essentially once or twice and spreading out from the centre.
I'm sure you can argue that, and you know tremendously more about it than I do. I just quite like my model. I think it explains more. we're talking about this. Sorry.
Paul Mullins from Cambridge. Wouldn't your model have the implication that pretty well all hunter-gatherers ought to be practicing a certain amount of incipient agriculture, or wouldn't that be a fair implication for what you're saying?
I would like some of them to be. I mean, there is two views, isn't there? There's one view that says that hunter-gatherers sort of represent the way that human beings most other human beings might have been a long time ago. And there's another view that says that modern hunter-gatherers must be special because in some way they've been shoved out. So maybe they were just doing things differently. But my understanding is that there are quite a few groups who do sort of practice incipient agriculture. John Yellen, who I first got this idea that agriculture is very ancient from, he did this lovely study of the Hottentots in the Kalahari, and he found that they would keep goats for a few years, and then, for some reason or other, which he didn't necessarily fathom, but they would decide they didn't want to keep goats anymore, and they would get rid of them, and they would go back to hunting and gathering, and then they would say, well, let's get a few more goats, and they would keep goats again for a bit. And he says this, in a sense, represents what one might call the norm. Here are people who genuinely basically they're hunter-gatherers, but they keep some animals on the side. And in a sense, what he was arguing against was the notion that once people had discovered agriculture, they said, isn't this a terrific idea? Let's all do it. And immediately sort of zoomed off and did it in a sort of lovely Victorian notion that we all get better and better and better. And he said, in fact, to these people, this was just no big deal. They did it and then they didn't do it. And my understanding, too, is that, or somebody told me, but I haven't followed it up, that there are people knocking around in Brazil, who actually do, as they wander around the forest, they actually do look after certain patches of vegetation and then come back to them again. This, to me, is a sort of proto-farming. You must know a great deal more about this than I do, but my understanding is that there really are groups who do cultivate in this kind of way. But they don't regard it as a big deal. They're not moving towards, they're not sort of proto-farmers. They're just amateur farmers, which is a nice state that they're happy to stay in forever. Sorry, something about that. Oh, it's Rob, yeah, sorry.
I think you said there's something I was supposed to correct, but I can't remember what it was.
Oh, good.
What I might supply you with a name for your model, which is clearly the Twickenham model human evolution, that is that agriculture is all right as long as you're an amateur. I very much agree with your idea that farming is the crux that changes the whole story. To my mind, that until you have farming, humans have very little impact on the land. What I don't really like is in a sense the smearing of this back to the Pleistocene. I think that if you're doing your own model of disservice, by in a sense saying, well, farming is the thing that has a major impact, but then everything is a farmer back to the Australopithecine. And I think if you abandon that and actually look at the whole evolutionary timescale, timetable that's emerging, if you start to say, look, there seems to have been a whole series of fairly major events in modern evolution in the last 100, 200,000 years, and these have involved considerable replacement of populations in early hominids, then really you've got the compression, I think, necessary. where you've got humans, modern humans coming in, say, 40,000 years ago, within 30,000 years, you have agriculture. And that's a very different story from the old one, when we used to have 2 million years of nice, stable hunting and gathering, followed by, you know, this very rapid change. It seems to me that the new timescale actually brings things together, so you can begin to see the evolution of the species and agriculture very much farming as part of that. And I think that we'd actually find that an easier case to make than having a full Australopithecine baking bread.
And then I don't want Australopithecines baking bread. I really don't. I wouldn't mind Homo erectus, who I understand did have fire, doing things with fire that were actually designed to influence the way other animals move and where they gather. For example, which is what the Australian Aborigines traditionally do. And Rhys Jones at Canberra, you know, with his lovely expression that they practice fire stick farming. And people have said, why didn't the Australian Aborigines farm Australia? And the traditional view is, well, they were too primitive, they didn't know how to do it. The real answer, of course, is that nobody in their right mind would farm Australia. it's not farmable. But the other thing is that, in a sense, I don't want to say that as it, I mean, I know you know this, but I just want to re-emphasize it, that I don't want to say that the kind of proto-farming that, let us say, the Australopithecines putatively did affected wildlife in the way that Mr. and Mrs. Andrews affected wildlife, i.e. by creating different landscapes which were hostile to other animals. Absolutely not. But all I want to suggest is that by doing a little bit of farming on the side, they raised their own populations, and they raised their own ability to maintain high populations when other populations were low. They didn't go down when the prey went up. In other words, they increased their dangerousness as predators. And it wasn't the farming itself that affected everybody else. It was the increase in the impact of the people who are farming that affected everybody else. And I quite like the idea. I don't know why you think my idea doesn't work. But when people went into America, they already, in the broad sense, knew about farming. They already did. I reckon. I mean, this is just an idea, but I don't see why, when they killed out the mammoths, which it seems to me they very obviously did, why they weren't actually targeting them. I mean, everybody says, you know, that they inadvertently managed to shoot too many. I say, did they hell? They knew exactly what they were doing. They said, we don't want these damn things around the place. And they shot them, I reckon. I mean, why not? It's a perfectly good idea, which I believe should be discussed. So I think my model works as well. Genevieve.
You spent the first half looking gloomily forwards to population growth at various rates, and the second half looking backwards to agriculture, and you sort of connected the two. But how do you see changing agriculture feeding future populations? I mean, does agriculture now have anything to do with population growth?
Doesn't it?
Well,
what else is going to sustain the population?
You said that agriculture could not sustain future populations. So is agriculture going to continue in its present direction?
I said... Well, my dear God knows what I said now. I mean, it's too late. But what I would say is that if you designed agriculture in a way which was genuinely designed to feed people, and you know perfectly well what one might mean by that, then it would be a good guess that one could, in fact, sustain, let us say, the present population indefinitely, and possibly a bigger one, possibly even twice as many. But unless... Well, to me, it's touch and go. I mean, it's just touch and go. Whether the population levels out before, that's it, really. Richard.
Richard Weber, I see. The point is about agriculture that it's not been designed to feed people, and yet for the last 50 years it has managed to feed people, and it has managed to produce a growth of yields through the green revolution and all that stuff that exceeds the growth of population. We're on the brink of a new green revolution, which is the development of biotechnology that changes the whole mode of designing plants from selective breeding and crop and pest management to actually designing new traits so you can grow bananas in seawater and that sort of thing. It's only, these things have arrived, they're only a few years away from practical application. I wouldn't wish to damage your doom-laden vision, but do you see any hope in the new technology in recapturing marginal land or in keeping pace with the rate of human growth and so on?
Well, one thing is that recapturing marginal land is very, very bad news for the animals that live on marginal land, which where they've been pushed to. So I'm also interested in conservation, so it wouldn't be good news from that point of view. I mean, the answer is yes, of course, if you can get saline-resistant barleys or wheat, you can grow them on the seashore. There are saline-resistant barleys already, yes. I mean, so the answer is yes, technology is going to do wonderful things. I heard you say the other day, and I thought you were going to say it now, but let me answer a question you raised the other day, I didn't raise it now. The notion that one might, for example, get a tenfold increase in crops by, let us say, hydroponics. And as you mentioned, the Negev, where in fact this has entirely been achieved. But I have been sort of thinking about this. And the real point is that I've been to the Negev, and it's pretty... What they grow in the Negev is bad strawberries out of season. I mean, it's horticulture, and it's purely fancy, and it has zilch impact on human nutrition, and neither is it intended to. And the serious crops are the staples, the grains, the tubers, and the pulses. And you grow them outdoors, and you grow them outdoors because it's cheap, and the whole of the Ukraine is given over to wheat. I haven't been to the Ukraine, but I believe it is given over to wheat, because that's how much space it takes. Now, let's supposing you could increase the yield of wheat tenfold by growing it in a greenhouse hydroponically. I don't believe you could, but if you did, you still have to ask the question, is it cheaper to use the whole of the Ukraine to grow wheat, where you can run your combines up and down, or is it cheaper to build a greenhouse one-tenth of the size of the Ukraine and grow it in there? And the answer is it's cheaper to grow it all over the Ukraine. And nobody would dream of going down these hyper-intensive routes until they had finished with the cheap, extensive routes. They really wouldn't. And I just don't see them...
I think it's different because they are doing that. And if you look at the large starter manufacturers in the States, they are doing that. They're not planting in the Ukraine. They're moving to highly engineered plants. So that's...
No, no,
it's
not really.
It's
not true fact. Sorry?
Could actually successfully feed a growing population. What would that do to your model of the world actually
burning out? There's a huge amount of deception involved with hyper intensive agriculture because of the resources you bring in from all sorts of other areas. I mean, you know this as well as I do. So it's not actually anything like as clever as it looks when you boil it down. It's the same. I'm absolutely certain that if everything was, if all the technologies that one could envisage in the next 50 years were applied, maybe one could increase the world's food output, I don't know, 5-6 times? I mean, possibly. But you don't come away from, you can't get away from this arithmetic, can you? You can't get away from this doubling every 40 years, unless. So one has to say, well, maybe in 100 years' time, somebody like me will be giving the same talk with different figures, twice as big, but you know, sometime, if it's not the end of the 21st century, it's going to be the end of the 22nd century. Doesn't it, in a sense, make any difference? See what I mean? Of course you do. We are not going to go on doubling food intake every 40 years. That is a prediction. It's not going to happen.
But we might continue to double food intake production long enough to allow the population to crash for some completely different reason.
Yeah. There's all kinds of possible.
So it might not be food shortage that actually does the damage.
It might not be. I still think that's the most likely one. But maybe you. Well,
on this
might not.
Gloomy point, we'd better stop. So I have my presentations.